continuation of our medical society's commitment to keeping you informed about the changing landscape of COVID-19. It is our privilege to welcome Dr. Travis Scales, Chief Health Officer for Montgomery County, to discuss the county's continued reopening plan and the impact of the health of our citizens. So just a few reminders before we begin. As you see, we will be muting all the participants so we can ensure that the sound quality is great. So a few reminders, please visit Montgomery County Medical Society's website, montgomerymedicine.org, and MedKai's website, medkai.org, to access the many resources which are constantly updated there. Also, MCMS has launched a hashtag Call Your Physician campaign to get patients back into your practices for routine care, immunizations, and or for more critical care, and even surgeries they've postponed during this time. So we encourage your participation in the special webinar also sponsored by the Maryland Department of Health, which will be tomorrow, Thursday, June 18th. This is a special webinar that will be from 1 to 4 to discuss reopening primary care practices. The link to register was in the email that you received from Jean Ransom today from MedKai. And so you can find that there, but certainly you can reach out to us if you have trouble finding that. Another issue, certainly acquiring enough PPE to open, is a continuing challenge for some practices. In addition to being able to access PPE through the County Health Department, MCMS has rolled out a new partnership with Handcraft Linen to help you acquire adequate PPE. So you can also look for some information about this in e-news, and we encourage you to complete the PPE form with the County Health Department. So without further ado, we'll move on to tonight's discussion. And as you know, Montgomery County will begin phase 2 of reopening Friday evening. And we've asked Dr. Gales to address the anticipated health impacts of reopening and the general messaging that will be used to reduce transmission as we all begin emerging from our homes and our cocoons. So we've also asked Dr. Gales to provide updates on testing, including availability, private versus public testing and retesting, continuing hotspots in the county, and contact tracing. And remember, you can pose questions via the chat function in the Zoom platform. I'll try to keep track of that, and we'll also take a few questions at the end of Dr. Gales' presentation, in addition to opening the meeting to our physicians' comments or challenges that you may be facing in caring for our patients. So Dr. Gale, thank you. We welcome your update.
Good evening, everyone, and always a pleasure to be with you. As Dr. Pham pointed out, we are moving to phase 2 on Friday. It's been a busy week, so I'm back to not really knowing which days of the week it is, but on Friday. And so part of that, the reason why we're able to do that is because we did see significant improvement and our metrics that we put forward that we have continued to look at, including our number of new cases, particularly in the setting of increasing averages of testing. And it's important to point out that we don't publish the numbers, but we continue to, we've tested more residents than any other jurisdiction. We've now tested over nearly 7.5% of our population and completed nearly 90,000 COVID-19 tests across the different types of testing, or at least for nasal PCR-related testing. And our test positivity rate is now under 8%, the 7-day average, as well as during this time period, the average number of tests that are being done throughout the county has continued to increase. We've actually seen a number in the last week, 4 or 5 days, where we have actually more days than not cases under 100, which again is promising. Our average, our 3-day average, actually was down to 55 yesterday, and with a slight uptick to 110 this morning, it's now up to 73, I believe. And so if 110 is our worst case scenario, that does show significant improvement from where we were even last week. Now, with that said, we still know that there are pockets within our community that continue to be disproportionately impacted by viral load. And to that end, we have identified the zip codes that continue to have the 10 highest number of cases. Now, we will continue to respond countywide, but we're really focusing in on those neighborhoods. And we actually had our, to that end, we had our first meeting of our public health advisory group. Dr. Berger is a part of that group. And we will be meeting again on next week to follow up from our meeting last week and any development from this week moving into next week. But two of the things that we talked about within that is prioritizing those areas that do still have a high burden of disease, as well as exploring the concept of being able to eliminate as much as possible household transmission from cases to case to case. And we know that in particular in some of those, if you take out the congregate living situations, including nursing homes and assisted living facilities, we still see in a lot of those zip codes a good amount of cases where we have an index case that lives in a high resident situation where there may be multiple families sharing one home. And we have seen in a number of instances, probably somewhere around 20% of our cases tied to household transmission, where it's difficult for individuals who test positive to isolate and for others who have come into contact to quarantine. The county is exploring and has identified options for individuals who are not able to isolate effectively to make provisions for them to shelter in other areas away from their families to minimize transmission. We continue to express as part of those focusing on those zip codes, increasing testing capacity for the entire county, but specifically in those areas. We have increased capacity at our current testing sites, and effective next week, we will have volunteers to stand up our mobile test unit that will allow for additional support to test in those current spaces, to be able to go on site to group homes or nursing homes or other facilities to test, as well as to help support pop-up testing efforts in areas that are non-clinical spaces, non-traditional spaces, but maybe potentially more accessible, meaning they're walkable by clients. They may not necessarily require appointments. It may not require a referral, which has historically been tied to other testing sources. So that will go live on next week. And in addition to that, we are rolling out our high throughput self-collection mechanism that we've talked about before. We've been able to work through a lot of those logistical issues. And we've done some soft launches with a small group of folks so far to test the system out. And included in that, I see a question popped up from medical providers. Really, testing at this point should be for everybody. The provisions this week, there was a letter sent out by the Maryland Board of Physicians, which is consistent with the guidance that we provided about a month ago, laying out criteria for individuals to be considered for testing who are asymptomatic. First line responders, essential employees, including healthcare workers, nursing home staff, assisted living facility staff, group home staff, grocery store workers, those kinds of folks, as well as our nursing homes and assisted living groups, because we know those folks are at high risk. Now, so we're rolling that out, and that will start in phased approaches. In addition to folks, those categories that I laid out, we are looking at how we can create some pop-up venues where we can do high throughput testing, where we can test, you know, hundreds and even potentially thousands of folks at a given time period. Now, as we move forward, one of the other significant components of that, and I'm seeing questions pop up on the bottom of my screen. So all of the tests that I'm talking about right now are PCR related. Once we get this rollout, we have also behind the scenes been exploring how we can leverage and launch access to antibody testing, which is a separate animal. But for now, we're getting the PCR test out to try to catch as many acute infections as we can so that we can get these folks quickly isolated and interrupt the networks of transmission. Because ultimately, the goal we want to get to, and I think this speaks to anticipated questions about now that we're moving into phase two, which I will come back to in a second, what determines our ability to move to phase three? In large part, we've got to see significant, practically no cases. I mean, when I say practically no cases, the ability to say that our daily averages are maybe 10 to 12 cases, very small amount of cases, where when they are identified, we can just roll out the artillery with our contact tracing staff and our linkage to social support services, identify those cases quickly, isolate them, and identify any clusters that may exist to shut down potential for transmission. Now, the general public probably won't understand that because now they're like, well, we'll start Friday and then 14 days moves from there, right? Not necessarily. I think, unfortunately, we have seen a number of instances in the last week where there have been jurisdictions who have moved forward in terms of reopening quicker and more extensively and not quite as measured as we have. And they are now having to walk back provisions or pause their reopening due to increases in cases. You look at the cases in Arizona, Texas, Florida, even today, I think the city of Miami said they're pausing any further reopening due to increases in cases. And one thing to point out, someone asked me yesterday, actually, or I think maybe today in our press conference, press briefing, is this tied to protest or large gatherings? No. In fact, in Montgomery County in the last 7 to 10 days, we've seen significant number of demonstrations and large gatherings, and we've actually seen a decrease in cases during that time period. The data actually shows, and if you want to reference it, there was a great interview with the mayor of Phoenix from a couple of nights ago who was asked that question, and she said, no, across the state, they've had numerous jurisdictions that did not have large gatherings, and their epidemiologists tied it more to rapid reopening more so than anything else. And so I think it's a cautionary tale for us and all of our residents to understand that even though we've seen improvements, we still have to remain vigilant. So to pivot a little bit to one of the earlier questions and comments is, and I saw a question, nobody in Arizona wears masks. One of the fundamental things that we've got to continue to promote is wearing face coverings. You read my mind. So every activity that we put forward in terms of phase two has been very carefully vetted. We came up with an initial list. We looked it over. We assessed it from a public health risk standpoint. And I'm going to selfishly say I'm a tennis player, and tennis ranks as one of the lowest risk transmission activities out there. Just saying. But we looked at all of the different activities to assess the risk of transmission. And if you notice some of those that we have allowed, those that may be a little bit higher risk, we have assigned some significant precautions. So we've put in capacity limits as well as continue to enforce face covering requirements in those areas. And in fact, we're drafting a health officer order that will specifically target face coverings and remind folks and emphasize that that is something that we've got to do. And not just, I should do it, but requiring that in places. And so in addition to that, we looked at that guidance to provide that because we do want to move forward and provide access to economic opportunities and recreational opportunities, but we want to make sure that they're safe. So I say all that to say that we're going to be enforcing very strictly face coverings in settings where it's difficult to maintain social distancing or physical distancing. That includes our indoor spaces as well as outdoor spaces where congregation may happen. In addition to that, we're going to make sure businesses abide by those and adhere to those policies, and there will be consequences in terms of potential closures and fines associated with that. We recognize that the majority of businesses and the majority of individuals have abided by those rules and adhere to those rules, and we're going to make sure that we do our part to identify those who haven't been doing that or aren't doing that so that we don't have to close down or walk back our provisions for everyone else who has been abiding by those practices. We continue to work with our colleagues across the Capital Region as well as the state of Maryland in terms of how we move forward, in terms of the activities we are permitting and the messaging behind that. We continue to meet regularly around those issues. And from the other piece I want to highlight is the contact tracing component. The state system that we are working with, partnering with the state, went live two Fridays ago, and we went live with our system last Monday. And since the system has gone live, we've had tremendous success in terms of contacting cases within 24 hours of their the results popping in the system. We've had 100% of our cases contacted within 24 hours in terms of an initial outreach, and we have been able to have successful conversations with over 76% of those individuals. The remaining individuals either didn't answer the phone or we got a wrong number, and we're developing strategies to continue to reach out to them to let them know of their results, as well as provide additional guidance in terms of prevention of further transmission. We're also working with the state to get additional epidemiology support from CDC, and that is moving forward. And that will help with our efforts in terms of understanding better the community transmission dynamics, whether we're talking about household transmission or any other factors that may come up that enhance transmission. I will stop there in terms of an overview, but happy to answer any questions. I try to anticipate with the questions popping up on the bottom of my screen, try to address many of those, but again, happy to answer any questions that you have. Thank you again for the opportunity.
Great, thank you, Dr. Gales. I think that was great addressing some of those as they popped up, but I did wanna go back to clarify a couple of things, especially with testing. It's encouraging to hear that the numbers have increased as far as we went initially when we had first started. We were at 5% and then 6% and then now 7%. Is that including people who are getting retested again? And then leading to that question also, you know, once someone gets tested, how frequently should they be retested? I mean, sometimes for a healthcare worker, for instance, a negative test doesn't help me as much as a positive test. Say, so how often should I be, you know, tested? And then is that captured into that percentage of our population who is being tested? And then I want to talk about if there's any bottlenecks as far as our testing capacity and how we can address that. But.
Sure. Well, to your first question, the numbers are broken down by the individual residents who've been tested and then the total number of tests. So the reference I gave, we have tested 7.3% of our residents, which is 76,396 individuals in Montgomery County, have received at least one COVID-19 test. The total number of tests that have been provided is 87,401 tests. Okay. And so that does show that some folks have received multiple tests. And that could include individuals by virtue of their work, or if you recall early on in the COVID tales, as part of re-entering society, you were required to have multiple negative COVID tests. So, you know, some mm-hmm. of those initial people did have multiple tests. Now, that's an interesting question, and we continue to think this through. In fact, before this call, we're on a call with the county agencies to talk about testing county employees and the requirements within that. Now, I think it varies depending upon exposure. For example, when we're looking at our nursing home populations, we're trying to figure out how do we reopen them successfully. And the idea is that any facility that has a positive case now, we should probably be testing them every 5 to 7 days, doing serial testing until we get negative results, to try to get as many identified cases, as many cases we can, as quickly as we can, to isolate folks. Now, I think in terms of healthcare workers, you know, I'm continuing to look at that, but, you know, we have, for example, there are a couple of hospitals that we're talking to about providing test access to the county test to be able to test their employees. And the thought is that they would probably do it on a weekly basis, again, 7 to 10 days, so that folks have, you know, up-to-date results. But I think there will be some variation within that with facility to facility. But at the same time, I think realistically getting tested on a weekly basis is probably the most frequent recommendation that I've seen so far.
Okay. And then as far as the testing capacities, because I know that there's private venues, for instance, the CVS rolling out, being able to get testing. And I understand, and someone on the call may correct me, but I understand that at CVS, it's a self-administered testing. And so I'm wondering whether or not there's a disconnect between the nasopharyngeal swab and reliability versus the patient who's being instructed by a member or pharmacist on how to do the testing, whether or not that's as reliable, and whether that's being captured into, is that being reported to the Department of Health?
So the different modalities, as you point out, have different sensitivities and specificities. And certainly that's been part of the issue. That continues to be an issue with the antibody testing, as well as some of the different testing modalities. Because if you recall, some of those, the Abbott rapid responder was initially hailed as the holy grail, but then there were significant issues with the specificity. I think it was only 60%. And they've, had to rework that a little bit. And so it depends on the mechanism, because again, the self-collection mechanisms are different. For example, we've used the two different collections we have. One is an oral swab, and one is also, we call it the spit kit, where it's a, you spit into a receptacle, and that is the mechanism. So it's a long one here to say it depends on the mechanism of testing that you're using. However, when different, those are the those are factored in terms of moving forward and how you use them. Now there are trade-offs. So a full nasopharyngeal swab probably is going to provide your most sensitive and most specific testing format. However, in order to do that, you can't administer it to yourself. You've got to have a trained individual to do it with personal protective equipment in a confined environment. So that has its advantages in terms of meeting those specificity and sensitivity goals, but it's difficult to do in a high throughput setting without a lot of parameters. Now, some of the trade-offs with some of the others, for example, I know some of the oral collection kits, I think sensitivity, what I saw was around 85 to 87%. The specificity was about 98%. But you, for example, you're able to get potentially thousands of people through that, and you collect it yourself, put it in a receptacle, and it's sent to the lab. So again, I think it just depends on the modality within that. I think the bottlenecks that have come, and I think this is one for the provider community, is around criteria. Who's getting tested? And so providers understanding that you have the ability to test, we're not in a shortage or crisis of absence of tests as we were in the very beginning. So you can use your clinical discretion in terms of providing tests to folks, particularly those individuals who are asymptomatic. And what we have laid out and recommended is that, again, anyone who fits those categories as an essential employee, first line responder, a healthcare facility worker, who's an asymptomatic but known contact of a positive case, those are folks who should be getting tested even if they're not demonstrating symptoms.
That makes sense. And I think someone else pointed out that the nasopharyngeal test may be a little too sensitive, and maybe sometimes positive tests aren't necessarily contagious. So that's the question too, how much, even if you get a positive test, what window is that person still, sort of contagious? As far as a bottleneck issue, I was actually asking about that as far as other counties. For instance, Baltimore Convention Center just opened up as a major center for their county. And then I know at Six Flags, they opened up. I know in Montgomery County, the thing I always look forward to is going to the fairgrounds. Are there any plans for us to be able to use that as a venue to get that high throughput, as opposed to using the vehicle emission sites? Because I know that's a little limited and also time.
Yes, there are plans to do so. Mm-hmm.
That's great. Not soon enough.
Well, so I think there has to be an understanding of, and this is something that I wish the public could understand a little bit more, testing is quite complicated. It is not easy to pull off logistically. And so when it comes to doing it, yes, we have the issues with the high throughput test. We are planning, we have looked at venues, large scale venues across the county, including the fairgrounds. And we have them in queue, ready to go once we've got the registration issues and those things figured out. So the short and long answer to your question is, yes, we would do that. We are planning to use similar venues. And I would point out that the mechanisms that are being used in Prince George's County as well in Baltimore City are utilizing still some aspect of a nasopharyngeal swab. And at least from my understanding, I could be wrong, have not included self-collection just yet. But we are actually working with health officers from multiple jurisdictions on how to roll out those plans. We've actually been doing, I joke with some of the health officers, we've been trying to iron out all of the details on our end so that we can get it to work and then say, yes, this is open for everybody. And we're hopeful, which is something I just want to also emphasize, if you know any health officers in any other jurisdictions, even though this has not been an ideal time for anyone, the spirit of collegiality and the collaboration and partnership has been fantastic across, you know, the politicians and elected officials don't always agree, but the health officers have been united in terms of our response and sharing information across jurisdictions to help each other out.
Well, that's great. That's definitely pretty encouraging. Then as a follow-up after testing, you know, certainly with the contact tracing, I think there are some things, you know, people talked about as far as contact tracing, whether or not all the venues are covered after the contact tracing. So even from physicians' offices or contact tracers are able to plug in, or is it just the public venues? And then second to that is, you know, what kind of modality? Is it just memory as far as trying to figure out, or are they using any kind of GPS, you know, their cell phones or anything? I know this is probably controversial, but just some ideas or thoughts, because I think it'd be pretty hard to, I don't even know what I had for dinner yesterday as opposed to where I was yesterday. So I don't know how difficult or easy that is. So we just touch on that.
Yeah, so contact tracing is done based upon the result and not where you were tested. And so the way the system works, and it's actually, I give kudos to the state for creating the system that is a shared platform. So now there is an electronic platform that all of the health departments have access to. It's housed at the state in terms of being able to track all of the cases. So when a case is reported into, and we even have a new surveillance system, the other one was outdated, so they've created a new surveillance system that the results feed directly in. Previously, the way it had to be done, and I know you're gonna be like, really? Is this, and this speaks to one of the components of, you know, public health is often underfunded, and some of the mechanisms we have in place are fairly outdated. They are functional, but they're outdated and it's not as modern. For example, and I saw a duh that yes, it's underfunded. For example, everyone is excited about contact tracing, but contact tracing has been cut for the last 5 years. So that said, they created a new database that's more up to date. Because before, we have to pull it off the state system, manually enter it into an Excel spreadsheet to be able to track the cases. And in some instances, we still receive results by fax. They weren't in the electronic system. So it's a little archaic, even though it's 2020. Now with the new electronic system, we don't have to do that. Everything populates into the electronic database. So what happens is, if you are a Montgomery County resident, if you on your lab sheet and you put a, you have a Montgomery County zip code, that is sent to Montgomery County. Now with the new state platform, the contact tracers at the state level, we've signed agreements that they can contact they've committed to at minimum contacting the first 1,000 cases on a daily basis. So anyone who has a result in that system, they get immediately. So if let's say we had 500 cases across the state today, they are pulled, the contact tracers call them right away. That information is put into the system and it's shared with the local jurisdiction to be able to participate and supplement that process in terms of follow-up, as well as if their contacts identify, to your point in terms of memory, if their contacts identify based upon their investigation, their initial interview, our team, along with the state in some instances, provide that follow-up to contact those contacts, get them access to testing, and do any further investigating that needs to happen from that. Now, we have explored and looked into utilizing or analyzing GPS-type technology. It has been fairly controversial. In fact, there is one lawsuit out, actually, in terms of using it. So we have not used it to date. That said, it's not that we won't, but we've not used it now because there's a lot of privacy concerns. And in fact, I don't think many jurisdictions across the U.S. have used them. Most of those who've used them and used them successfully have been other countries. But that said, you know, it's not off the table. We're looking at how to use that more effectively. Now, what we are doing to expand our contact tracing army now that the new system is in place is we are reaching out to community agencies to recruit a diverse cadre and pool of folks. So if you know anyone who's interested, yes, the opportunity is still there to volunteer. But we are going through the contract process working with a local agency who is going to hire a number of brokers, as well as meeting with, for example, we have a meeting with Casa de Maryland tomorrow to talk about partnering in terms of bringing on, identifying a good amount of potential contact tracers who are part of or very familiar and culturally aware of the Latino community to provide outreach there. And we have similar efforts with a number of Asian, I know that's broadly defined, community agencies. We're working with the Association of Haitian Professionals and similar outreach efforts with the Ethiopian and Eritrean community here in the county.
Okay. Well, going back to that, actually, one thing that you had said about the privacy, I'm not sure if this is a question that you may be able to answer or actually related to employment law and privacy, but I think we had sent a possible question about, for instance, in a medical practice office, if an employee had tested positive or we know that they are returning to work, who had taken care of someone who is positive, what is our role as an employer to our other employees to let them know that they've been exposed without, you know, breaching any privacy or HIPAA issues, certainly, and or do we leave that to the contact tracers? How does that work, especially if it's a small office and someone is out prolonged, then you sort of know. So I don't know if it's something that you necessarily be able to answer, but if you've come across that, or we can also ask an employment lawyer, a labor lawyer.
So you can always ask the employment labor lawyer. I don't speak legalese, so you can always get the legal opinion. But what I will say is that's part of the disease control process. So if at any point it's discovered that an employee of a particular agency or organization or doctor's office has tested positive, as part of their interview, that information will be gathered. And if it's determined that they have anyone that they work with is potentially at risk of exposure, then their employer and any other potential individuals would be contacted to say, hi, you were exposed. The name is not provided, but just to say, you know, you were potentially exposed. Now, we've had this happen many times. We've had it in government agencies or other employees where you're right. Sometimes you're gonna know who it is. You're gonna be like, well, process of elimination tells me it's this person. If individuals find out or by process of elimination, discover it or figure it out on their own, that's on them. But the HIPAA protections for you as an employer, the responsibility is to, I would say, work very closely with disease control staff in terms of guidance to provide that and share that information. But you should not disclose the name unless it's an emergency situation where there are special provisions. That you can disclose the name, but the reality is the situation, the way it's handled is there's a blanket information release to say, hi, if you were here between these dates, or, you know, you were potentially exposed and we advise you to get tested and quarantine for a period of time, including getting tested during that process.
Great, that makes a lot of sense and I think is very helpful as well. So we certainly have covered a lot about testing and contact tracing. I wanted to then move past that then to what we wanted to go to was the reopening, getting some clarification as far as, you know, patients are going to be asking us as physicians, getting some clarification on what activities are okay. For instance, playgrounds. What number of people are allowed at one time, length of time, recommendations on how often or timing of the cleaning, things like that. What are us other low-risk sports? I know that an infographic came out from Yahoo about tennis being level 1 and bars being 9, basketball being like a 7 or something like that. So are things like cross-country, you know, running in groups? I know biking was okay, but I was just wondering – if you had any clarification on those types of activities.
Yeah, so there was guidance, particularly for youth sports, related to the number, and the state did not release any restrictions in terms of the quality of contact. However, as a county, we will be taking a more active approach and putting restrictions on in terms of keeping it low contact sports. Now, that said, so we're actually drafting that. My homework assignment after this call is working on that guidance that we're putting out. Within that, if you were bored out of your minds and had spare time yesterday and saw our council briefing, you said we were going back and forth about the executive order. So we're going to be issuing some clarifying language on some of those things. And so, for example, contact sports. So the stance that I take, and as a pediatrician and adolescent medicine guy, is that high contact sports do carry a risk of transmission. As you pointed out, there's a differentiation between that. That said, it should not prevent activities from happening that are low contact. So, for example, you can think of a football team who's doing summer drills. We're saying no tackling and no contact, but you can get together, you can do conditioning drills, you can run, you can do everything else, you can lift weights. And so those activities that are low contact can be maintained. So cross-country teams running, they really ideally shouldn't be coming into contact with each other. So those types of things will be allowed. And in fact, we low to no contact sports were allowed in phase one. The capacity was at 10. The second phase will increase the capacity to 15, but there will be a continuation and a requirement for those to be low to no contact. But again, for those sports that may carry higher contact, we're not preventing them from being able to get out and do other drills or other conditioning type activities that minimize contact that can contribute to their health and wellness. Trying to think of other things.
Playgrounds.
So what playgrounds about? Will be open. However, in terms of, we're still requesting people, to be careful about congregating, emphasizing physical distancing, being careful and mindful of using the equipment. I don't believe there will be, I'll have to look in it again because I've got them all mixed in my head in terms of provisions and requirements for cleaning. So it will be kind of, again, recommended to use very carefully, cautiously, maintain as much distance as you can between you and other families outside of your network.
Okay. And then with regards to all of doing all of this, I know we've been really pushing towards face coverings. And what about using face shields? Is that face? I think someone asked the question. Any opinion as far as face shields?
I mean,
in lieu of face covering, I don't know.
Well, the reality, I mean, I don't know many folks who have access to face shields. what we're encouraging folks to do is the reason why we're promoting face covering. So all of those things are effective tools, don't get me wrong. So surgical masks, N95s, face shields, those are great. But the reality is we're trying to protect as many of those for our healthcare providers in the event that there's a shortage. And we get crunched from a PPE perspective. So that's why we've introduced and continue to promote the face coverings of non-surgical grade or non-equipment type things. Because one, that's what most folks have access to. And I see Dr. Corson doing a demonstration there. Most folks have access to those and they're simpler and easier to use and do offer some layer of protection. But if someone has a face shield, I wouldn't say no to it. Feel free to use it. It's just the reality is most likely most people have more access to it.
Right. And actually then on that note, I don't remember reading exactly everything on the phase two reopening plans, but what about neighborhood swimming pools? And I'm sure you've seen the trikini, the face covering with the bikini. I don't know if that's something that's going to be a fad then go in the summer, but I don't know if community pools, I know they're being prepared and everything's being cleaned. And early on when, before we had shut down, I think there was some data talking about how it wasn't spread through that pool venue. And I know that parents are going to be asking their pediatrician. So I was wondering if you could touch on that.
Sure. So swimming in pools, I mean, it's got chemicals in there. So it's the actual act of swimming in the swimming pool doesn't carry a huge risk. It's everything that comes with the swimming pool. And so what we've seen is, particularly, I think back to the, there were swimming parties in the Ozarks in Arkansas and Missouri a couple of weeks ago, that there was a significant outbreak. It wasn't really tied to people swimming in the pool. It was the congregating outside the pool, sharing equipment, not cleaning surfaces, not wearing face coverings. And so that's the big concern with the activity. So when we sat down and looked at it, originally we were only going to do lap swimming. And we said, again, you know, the actual act of swimming and being in the pool is, you know, there's a transmission risk everywhere, but it's the other stuff. And so what we did is we said, you can do this. We can open up pools. So community pools can be open. You know, indoor and outdoor facilities, but there are capacity limits. So there's guidelines that pool owners will have to say, here's your capacity limits. The formula is something like dividing the square footage by 36, and that gets you a number that approximates what you can safely do with keeping people 6 feet apart, requirements for cleaning of surfaces, as well as requiring both individuals, I was saying clients earlier, but patrons outside the pool to wear face coverings when they're not in the pool, and any lifeguards or other staff required to have face coverings as well. If there is lap swimming, we've restricted it to one swimmer per lane. So there are hosts of other things that we've put into place to make the activity as safe as possible and allow people to do it. So that is actually allowed as part of phase two. Now, very, very carefully, though, a reminder, if you are talking to people who own pools, yes, they are open, but they still have to be inspected. So if they have not gone through their annual inspection process, they cannot open up until they have been inspected by our licensing and regulatory service team. And we had actually promoted over the last few weeks, probably over the last month or so, to say that even if they're not open, go ahead and clean and get ready. So the minute we go live, you don't have to wait. And so I just want to remind folks that from the health perspective, it's an allowed activity, but pools still have to be inspected through the traditional process.
Well, that's promising, because I definitely think the kids need to get out and get into the pool, but the new trikini fad is definitely going to be, yeah. So basically it's a bikini, and then you actually have a matching face covering that goes on the face. So you can buy it that way now. So you heard it here.
I guess that introduces a new stock option. I don't know. I hadn't heard of that one before.
Yeah. So as far as for all of this, I mean, now then following as far as the after, terrible tan lines. That's exactly what I was trying to say. There's going to be terrible tan lines, but I know there's a dermatologist on the call, and we're probably going to all be just better to just cover our entire face, you know, like they have in Asia. But anyway, as a follow-up.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that, because we did a video that we're putting on our social media about pools, basically taking what I just said into a minute. And the first thing I mentioned, though, was like, before we talk about safety, please wear sunscreen. Like, let's not forget regular preventative medicine. Wear sunscreen. Right. So once you get that down, yes, let's talk about how you stay safe in the pools and keep good and cold.
Well, that's good. That's a good segue. Actually, you took my bait, because the next thing was about, you know, the after, as far as we set up that topic with regards to the vaccine administration, distribution planning. I mean, we haven't forgotten, you know, and that's why we had that hashtag call your physician campaign, you know, call your pediatrician, get back on your immunization schedule, resume your routine care. Are there any specific updates on the medical advisory board and vaccine, you know, immunization task force? How can we help you as far as going through that? And then I know AstraZeneca is right in, you know, my backyard. Are there any plans for us to sort of work with them to kind of say, oh, you know, we got first dibs or something?
Well, so I will say this in terms of a potential COVID vaccine. We are working on a plan for distribution the team has been tasked with that, to say eventually, well, optimistically, this is going to come. Let's have a plan in place anticipating this, realistically probably in the fall, early winter, fingers crossed. As part of, as you know, we do our annual flu vaccine ramp up. Now, as it relates to immunization, so this county immunization clinic will open back up, I believe July 6th is the date that we've set. And we will be sending out more information on that. From a state perspective, the Immunization Commission, we sent a letter to Governor Hogan to advocate for him as part of his reopening comments to make sure that he includes comments that are related to immunizations and encouraging folks to get their immunizations. I confess I take responsibility for it because I was sending the letter. I got it in probably a little bit later than when he had already put in his remarks for his first reopening. But we've talked to the Department of Health, who is in support of it, and hopefully in his next press conference when he talks about reopening or further actions, he mentions that as a part of that strategy. Our team is working particularly around the pediatric vaccine community. We had, before COVID, have been looking at strategies to increase access and have been working with a couple of agencies to roll some things out. With COVID in place, we've had to reconfigure some of those things, and we'll be releasing more information about that probably over the next 6 weeks or so before school starts. That will also include more information about our, you know, on a usual basis, we do preschool vaccine clinics, and the team is working on setting up those times and what that might look like. So stay tuned on that front. There will be more information coming.
That's helpful. And actually, you know, I wanted to just highlight, I think Dr. Siegel just put a word of caution about how, you know, certainly there is a possibility of the transmission. I think he said grand rounds from our OB department and had 6 cases of pregnant women who had COVID, mm-hmm. and 3 got it from the children. So highlighting the need that certainly we need to vaccinate, you know, our children. In any case, just being mindful of everyone's time, I think we've covered quite a lot, and I wanted to see if there were any additional questions for Dr. Gales. If you're on your phone and you have a question, you can certainly hit *6 to unmute yourself. I think we tried to address all the questions on the chat function. So I wanted to just open it now to invite all the physicians on the call to share any other concerns as well as any challenges. If you wanted to make a comment, if you could please just say your name, and if you're asking a question to Dr. Gales, you can address it to him. Thank you.
Hi, Dr. Gales, I'm Diane Snyder. I'm a gynecologist in town. Sorry about the playground thing, but I'm about to go on to another call where I'm in charge of a reopening for an organization I'm in, and where they want to reopen the playground. So I had some. So is there a number of people that's restricted on a, we have a private playground, restricted to a playground?
Well, we've.
At one time.
So technically, I mean, it all depends.
Depends
so,
on the know, size, probably.
Well, it depends on the size and the factors. So, I mean, for example, the limit on gatherings in public space, you know, social gatherings was 10. That has been or will be increased to 50. So it's really about the context in terms of making sure that there's ample and adequate spacing between different families and the children to use it safely. You know, I can get you more specific access to the language around, you know, the equipment and those recommendations. But the playground can be open. Just making sure that, you know, folks, again, remember to keep adequate physical distancing in place and not congregating in those spaces. And if any of the equipment is used, being mindful about wiping them down or cleaning any surfaces they may come into contact with.
Is there any recommendation specifically for cleaning just after every use or at some interval?
I would say after every use. I mean, is that at this point there is it with all of the playgrounds in the county, it would be difficult to come up with a schedule to do it, you know, to expect DGS to do it on a, you know, a continuous basis. So the recommendation would be, you know, if I had kids, but if I had kids and then we were at the playground, We would certainly be cleaning surfaces before use and after use. Okay. I think is a good policy to have.
Okay, thank you. And how about gyms? You didn't mention the gyms.
So gyms are actually going to be allowed to reopen with significant capacity limits. It's one patron per 200 square feet of each facility. We are requiring that folks wear some type of face covering while they're working out. And they're pretty strict requirements for the gyms to be able to clean the surfaces and equipment that they're using.
So that's in that those are that's the indoor spaces.
Yes, indoor spaces.
Because
yes.
Outdoor is already allowed and yes. Open. And now who are the fitness centers being told these guidelines as far as the requirement with the coverings, and how do you ensure they enforce that?
So they are being, the guidance is being shared with businesses, and I know some folks have, I think someone sent me a tweet today calling me a crazy nut because I'm saying that you have to wear a face covering when you're working out. I've been called all sorts of things, and that's fine. But the reality is that folks have to understand that we're putting in parameters to keep people safe, because the alternative is we keep stuff closed. So, you know, I had a friend actually on social media, Northern Virginia has opened up their gyms since last week, who tweeted a picture, was lifting weights with the mask on and that, you know, face covering, that was safe. And I don't think they're actually requiring it, but, you know, I was like, thank you, I appreciate that. Because that's what, you know, we're trying to keep people safe and not, you know, forbid activities or prohibit activities to do it. So it was tricky. So I said, let's say we're providing the guidance to them. We are enforcement team, so to speak, and enforcement's a tough term because we don't want to sound punitive, is we do have they're called the COVID Corps, and a group of ambassadors who are a mix of county employees and volunteers who are going around our jurisdiction to provide assistance to businesses and facilities to help them. And certainly as we continue to move forward, if there are businesses or entities that have been identified who are not adhering to those policies, there are further steps that can be taken to investigate them and make sure that they either adhere or there are penalties and consequences. And I'm enjoying all of the different catchphrases. I haven't heard some of these mask it or casket, six feet, what is it?
6 feet apart or 6 feet deep.
6 feet
yeah,
deep.
I think that's Dr. Rockauer's, we found his calling. But
we'll
as
have
far
to get
as,
you on our next press briefing to provide that for folks.
But speaking of, as far as the guidelines, then are there any plans with regards to the restaurants and with the indoor seating, for instance, having restaurants owners attending a 2-hour workshop on saying, okay, this is what I would recommend for your staff, checking temperatures and before they go to work, and sort of just guidelines. And then those restaurant owners who attended this workshop sort of get a little bit of a certification and saying, okay, this is an okay place to go eat, or I don't know, just an idea.
So we're not doing that, but what we are doing is we're requiring them to they are getting provided guidance, and in fact, going back to phase one, before phase one went in, the business and commerce side of the government team has been working with businesses to get ready and prepare for this. So, I've not been a part of those conversations. We provided guidance for them to share to do that. And, you know, there are going to be some requirements where, you know, folks have to put up signage that says, you know, no mask without any face coverings. Face coverings are required in the facility, that kind of thing, or you won't be served. And so, again, we're not trying to be mean. We're just trying to make sure we keep moving in the right direction and people adhere, because, you know, I think from a health perspective, there are activities that can be enjoyed. they can be enjoyed safely. And if we do the things that we need to do, I you know, some of you may know, I spent years in Chicago, and Chicago and the state of Illinois has moved very, they actually, I think, are the only state to officially meet all of the CDC guidelines as they move through each phase, and they're on phase three. So you can imagine, I know they've been hit hard by a number of other issues, but you can imagine a city of 3.5 million people being able to move through each phase and achieve these goals because folks are adhering and doing what they need to do. And so that's what we're trying to promote and emphasize here.
So Dr. Gales, as I know you're an adolescent medicine person, so I do pediatric and adolescent GYN, and just a funny or not, from the last 2 weeks, I've had three teenagers being brought in by their mothers, sneaking their boyfriends into the house at night after parents are asleep. And so I'm like, okay, normally they, you know, they're not so, have good judgment, but now with COVID, it's even more stupid. So I said, not putting their parents at risk, and they, you know, and the COVID risk to themselves. So it's a whole new level of counseling for me.
Well, it introduces what's also something to think about is, I know a lot of our attention has been on COVID, and there's, you know, the other comorbidities from the chronic disease perspective that we've talked about and will continue to work through. But then, you know, as Dr. Rockover, you read my mind, you know, there is the, there's a lot of activity happening already and will probably happen even more as things open back up and people have more access to testing. And in fact, so about 6 weeks ago, we sat down with our STI clinic and said, we need to make sure that we are stocked up on medications because we anticipate there's going to be a higher amount of traffic coming through as things open up again. Now, I don't have any quantitative data to support that right now, but anecdotally, that's proven correct so far.
As far as for that, I actually had read something and had asked the question to some other of my colleagues as far as how are you counseling, you know, patients about who are asking you about dating and meeting new people, that, you know, intercourse may be okay, but stay away from kissing or something like that. So it's kind of an interesting thing that you brought up, Dr. Snyder. So, but anyway, I did want to ask that, going back to the COVID core, Susan was asking how would the COVID core investigate physicians' offices, actually, if reported that physicians or staff are not wearing masks. Is that something that the core is actually looking at as well? I know that we had to attest, right, to the Department of Health, but I think that's sort of a self-attestation.
Sure. I think if you have any instance where you have heard about it or you have witnessed it in terms of a practice not adhering to it, please let our licensing and regulatory service team know. And I think that actually goes beyond an ambassador going in. I think that needs a, you know, that's a higher level of you know, investigation. And that's the kind of thing that we would, you know, get the state health department and board of physicians involved in that one. That would, you know, that one would be a lot more consequential. So if any of you know of any of that, please let us know and we'll be happy to take a look into it.
Great. Thank you. Do we have any other questions? I guess you answered every single question, and they're gonna be looking forward to seeing if we can move towards phase three.
I'd like to ask a question.
Yes.
Sure. Well, first of all, I wanna be where Mark Siegel is. That looks really nice.
It does look
beach
nice.
Somewhere. Yeah. That's not my question though. My question is, what is the ultimate authority on this? Because I've attended lots of webinars and I've gotten all kinds of information, and something I get one day is, you know, disagreed with the next day. And would you say the CDC is the ultimate authority? Is there one place to go for the correct information?
Well, technically speaking, the CDC is the ultimate authority in terms of, you know, the reference a lot of the guidance is pulled from. I know that in this current environment, that can be a little controversial at times. But the information that the CDC staff is putting out in terms of their guidelines, I have found to be on par. and up to date. That's what we use. I know the state, you know, pretty much everybody follows that. For example, I can think of, since we were talking about face coverings earlier, you know, all of the guidance have been asymptomatic folks don't transmit. So there's really low utility of wearing face coverings. So then when that changed, you know, there was more information put out. Well, I think there was probably a couple, a New York Times article that suggested it first. And then I think Dr. Fauci mentioned it. And so a lot of us were changing the directives anyway, and then CDC guidance, you know, represented that. So I think, again, I think they have taken some hits. I think the folks, and when I'm saying the folks who the line staff, the people, the scientists and physicians who are working there are doing the best they can, and are doing a really great job in terms of getting information out, recognizing some of the political realities. So I say all that to say that we continue to use that as a source. You know, I try to minimize as much as I can, but I do spend some time reading journals, listening to the news to some degree to see if, you know, hearing about different studies. And in fact, what we did is we have had a number of residents rotate with us, and a couple of them have been, that's their assignment, to follow studies and follow the news and kind of give a brief daily update to say, this should be on your radar, go take a look at it. But what often comes back to is, you know, we do look at the guidance from CDC. We are in constant communication with our colleagues at the state. And then there's the, much like this conversation here, we, you know, do peer-to-peer. So for example, a lot of jurisdictions were releasing guidelines based upon 50% capacity or 25% capacity. And we were talking in one of the health officer meetings, we're like, wait, is there any actual evidence-based study that supports that approach? You know, where do we get 25? Why not 35? Or why not 50? And so after that conversation, a lot of us actually changed how we were looking at things and went to a square footage model where you had, you know, equations set up to be able to factor in volume and spacing and those kinds of things. And where possible, that's why when you look at our guidelines, they are, you know, one person per X amount of square feet, to be able to determine the risk within that. I know that's a long answer, but.
Well, I guess the important term is guidelines. We're really anxious to do everything right. I mean, I've been told, you know, people are not going to come and inspect you, and HIPAA is, you know, kind of loosened up, and I'm hearing all kinds of things, but are there laws and rules that we have to be following as opposed to choosing our guidelines? Mm-hmm. I mean, I've gone on to government sites and I just sort of can't find, you know, the rules.
Well, it's, you know, the federal guidelines. So, you know, CDC informing the state guidelines, and then, you know, the secretary coming up with directives, and those are the guidelines. That's kind of the chain of command, so to speak, in terms of how things have been done.
Thank you.
Great. Well, I think it's about that time. And on behalf of the Medical Society, Dr. Gales, I wanted to thank you for your leadership, your insights, and certainly your candor during these update calls. it's been a great dialogue, and I hope you'd feel the same, that, you know, I value our partnership. This is the last of our scheduled calls. However, you know, certainly welcome to have you convene future calls if you think there's issues or messages that you need to get out to the medical community. So I just wanted to sort of throw that out there. But before we sign off, I just also wanted to remind everyone of the survey regarding the impact of COVID on your practices, and your patients' practices are still open. And we'll put a link in the follow-up email that we'll send tomorrow. So we encourage you to complete the survey, because our local elected leaders are actually looking at possible funding sources to ensure adequate access to care during and the aftermath of COVID. So with that, we thank you for joining us for this most important update. Please watch your email for the information about future webinars and resources. And remember, MCMS and MedCAI are here for you. please get in touch if we can assist you with any questions you may have. And thank you again for joining us and for the important work you do caring for patients each and every day. I wish you a good evening. Good night.
Stay safe, everybody.
Yeah, you too. And sane.
Thank you, Dr. Cute. Gales.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks, Susan. Good night.